Alright, hold on. Okay. Let me get into character. Hold on a second. I need to warm up my vocal cords. Harder. Father. Okay.
You're listening to The Ben Shapiro Show on AM 770 KTTH.
It's become my catchphrase here on The Ben Shapiro Show that facts do not care about your feelings. Yet, we have inculcated an entire generation who thinks that their feelings are more important than my facts. And by way of illustrating this, I've been keeping a running tab on all of the grammatical errors, which are, in their own way, factual inaccuracies, in popular rap music. It's hardly English, and because it's the radio, you can't see that I'm using quotation marks around music, because it's not music. I want to discuss a latest song that someone sent me by an artist, again, in quotation marks, called Young Thug. Lovely name, lovely gentleman, Young Thug. I suppose his father is Old Thug, and his wife is Mrs. Thug. Once again, this is, you know, one of these words that some people can say, that liberals can say, but I can't say myself. When I talk about thug culture, the liberals, in their hypocrisy, will get mad at me. But here are the lyrics to a song that is called Future Swag. I don't know what swag exists in the future. I don't even know what swag is. But the song is called Future Swag, and it goes like this. Fuck on your baby mama. I fuck on your baby mama. Let fuck on your baby mama. Cause I wanna fuck on your baby mama. The song opens and he says, quote, I F on your baby mama. I F on your baby mama. Let's F on your baby mama. Cause I wanna F your baby mama. Some head from your baby mama. I need some brain from your baby mama. So he's talking about F-ing someone's, the mother of someone's child, then effing them in a group of people, and then getting some sort of lobotomy for this person who is the mother of a baby. I fuck on your baby mama. I fuck on your baby mama. Let fuck on your baby mama. Cause I wanna fuck on your baby mama. He just simply lovely, completely ungrammatical, not even words, not a song. No, there's not even rhymes. Until he says, Lil mama, she ready for war. She ready for dick in her ass and her throat. Little mama, she wet for the faculty. Little mama, she ready, she after me. This, folks, is what the twin poisons of anti-Semitism and multiculturalism have done to our culture and our society. This is what young thugs and old thugs are doing. And my good friend Andrew Breitbart, if he were still alive, he would say, the only thing I hate more than racism is thug culture and Young Thug. I'm ready for war, and I'm going to F on the left on the Ben Shapiro Show. I F on the left on the Ben Shapiro Show. I F on the left on the Ben Shapiro Show. Young Thug is not music. Rap is crap.
Okay, I need to blow my nose now. We are back. It's episode 38. I'm Will Muniker. Joining me as always, Felix Biederman.
Hey everybody.
And Matt Chrisman.
Hi folks.
It's been a busy week for us. A lot of doings, a lot of happenings going on in the Trap House universe. A lot of Goofies, Daffies, and Donalds quacking at us all week long. And I think we're going to talk about it. But before we do, we have quite a good interview set up, ready to go, by our friend Maria Hengeveld, who is an investigative journalist who traveled all the way to Vietnam to report on Nike shoes and their supply chain and how that fits into the Nike Corporation's attempts to empower women through a program called Girl Effect. So we have that set up. It's a very smart, informative, and educational interview, which, like I said, will hopefully serve as an antidote to the interview that we did with Brandon Wardell that actually has made anyone who listened to it stupider.
Yeah, you know, like Ron Fournier talks about, we do both sides. Like, it's equal parts being stupid and being spectrum. And in the middle, you find a mix, and that's called Applebee's brain disorder.
In the course of our interview with Brendan, I said I was reading Celine, and Brendan thought it was C-Lean, and he thought I was talking about a rapper. let's say we roll this interview about Girl Effect with Maria. What do you say?
Yeah.
Let's get into that, and then there's much to discuss about the wild and wacky week we've had after that. So, Maria, talk to us about Girl Effect. Girl. Maria, the title of the article in Slate is Nike boasts of empowering women around the world, while the young women who make its products in Vietnam are intimidated, belittled, and underpaid. Now, you did this big sort of investigative piece for Slate where you went to Vietnam to basically to investigate the Nike supply chain. But before we get there, could you tell us what Girl's Effect is, how it relates to Nike's sort of corporate branding, what it promotes, and why they started this campaign?
Yes, of course. Thanks, Will, and thanks for having me. So my background is in the gender and international development sphere. And in that space, like over the last 6 years, this idea that if you empower a girl, you are solving poverty because girls invest 3 times as much of their income back into their families. They will put their brothers through school, and so they make a very good investment. The sort of narrative that started to pop up like everywhere, and again, not just as like a sort of a feminist theory, but as a poverty reduction theory. And this idea of the term girl effect, you saw that being used in by many like celebrities as well, and journalists such as like Nicholas Kristof. So in like all these spaces, from like the UN to like big NGOs, major women's rights organizations started to talk about this. And what is it? So again, what I said, it's the idea that if you invest in a girl, that she will do the rest. This is literally like one of Nike's slogans that they used to use more. The idea that they use is that many girls in the developing world, so that's like across Africa, that's what they often focus on. Their potential is being held back because of local cultures, because of patriarchy, and so their parents and their communities, they won't let them be what they could be. They won't let them unleash their potential. But if they would, then their communities would thrive because they would take up jobs, they would become entrepreneurs, they would invest again all this money back, and they would lift themselves and their entire societies out of poverty. These ideas have been around since, let's say, the 80s, at least the idea that investing in women, that makes a good investment because they have more selfless spending patterns than men. But when Nike in 2008, with their foundation, when they coined this girl effect theory, and they started their campaign, it grew into like a common sense poverty reduction strategy. So Nike started this in 2008, and they got support directly from the Nova Foundation and from the United Nations Foundation. And over the years, they promoted the ideas through platform, like through like media channels like the Huffington Post, the Guardian gave them their own space. So this is how it sort of became a common sense, sort of widely accepted poverty reduction strategy.
You open the article with talking about the Olympics, and of course the Nike brand is right out at the forefront of all of that. It's this global event. It's an event where, you know, women compete at the highest levels, and so much of Nike's advertising of themselves during this campaign was about empowering girls and women, and particularly women of color, and associating that with the Nike brand. And like this campaign that you're talking about, the Girl Effects campaign, which is part of the Nike Foundation, is that kind of a key part in this branding effort that they're undertaking?
Yes, absolutely. So they focus specifically on girls, and of course it's going to be girls of color because they are concerned with the developing world or the global south, except for the countries where they actually have factories, which...
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second, but you know, I remember growing up, like there was a sort of like there was a dawning consciousness about this idea of sweatshops and the conditions in them and the connection to that and like the clothes that you wear. I remember there was some campaign about like, you know, you're a kid, you're wearing these sneakers, but did you know that like kids your age are sewing them together in factories, you know, that across the world. And Nike, of course, is probably one of the biggest companies in the world. It's the biggest like shoe and sort of like, I don't know, one of the biggest shoe and clothing manufacturers in the world. So even back then, they
started this major outsourcing trend. Like they were I think the first to start this, to take manufacturing like overseas, and yeah.
So like there's this dawning consciousness that you need, like if you're going to have like a giant company like Nike, you sort of need to bake into the product itself sort of the conscience of the people who are buying it, right? So they've been doing that for a while, but like how does this kind of the Girl Effect campaign, how is that sort of, is that kind of a new thing and a new direction for them, and sort of why, like what prompted them to start this campaign that focuses so heavily on empowering women?
They basically took over, they took the narrative over from there, like, okay, we get it, like this, you know, there is a big problem, we will change, we got
they,
it. We'll
they
take
pledged
it
as we say on the show, our catchphrase, they have pledged to do better, right? And this Girl Effect campaign
exactly
is part
yeah.
of it, right?
Yeah.
This is something I know
exactly.
we all can relate to.
I mean, it's the best type of do better, because, you know, it's what I mean when I say that I'll do better, which is do exactly the same shit but called something different.
Yeah, do exactly the same shit, but like, this is why it's such a good phrase, do exactly the same shit but sort of perform outwardly for other people contrition and demonstrate that like you get it, you know, like that, you know, I get it, but don't actually change your behavior. And this is where your sort of the investigative part of this piece comes in, because you traveled to Vietnam, and one of the things this is incredible to me in the Nike supply chain, and like the Nike and all of their subsidiary corporations, which include Converse and Hurley, they employ over a million people. And of that is a staggering number of workers. And of those million people, a third of them are in the country of Vietnam. And of those workers, the vast majority of them are women, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I think 80%.
80%?
Yeah, like more or less 80-81% are women.
And
yeah.
And you describe how there are, you know, like there are these huge factories and industrial parks outside, I think Ho Chi Minh City is the one that you talked about. And they are staffed mostly by women who migrate from rural areas in the sort of the rural areas looking for work and employment, and these are the people who make the majority of Nike products.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And the question that your article, I think, your article poses is, to what effect has the Girl Effect trickled down to the factories that produce Nike merchandise?
Well, that, but even more fundamentally, it's like, well, they really fit that profile, right? Of like of the Girl Effect, like that girl that they
these are the girls that we want to empower,
it's
right?
Like, well, shouldn't if your theory if this theory really works the way you think it does, then surely all those women in those factories are more empowered than, you know, we can even imagine, because again they really fit that profile, does this theory, which again is, has become common sense within UN agencies, with poverty reduction, like aid agencies, NGOs, like this idea, like how accurate is this really? That if you tell a girl that, you know, if you just believe in yourself and if your societies tell them like you have unlimited potential, this is what will solve poverty. Well, what I found out is that without a living wage, that's quite hard to do. Yeah.
One of the weirder, in the past few years, I feel like we've gotten some very weird, obtuse arguments for exploitation of workers in poor nations. One of them being, you know, how can we forget different countries have different safety standards and that's okay. To another Vox argument, which is, if you're pro-worker, then you will want these millions of people to be exploited because they're workers. We're just creating more workers. But the thing that I noticed with your piece and the arguments for this girl power is it's possibly the least complex of all these. It's sort of, it has the same rationale as like a success meme. You could write this entire platform on a screenshot from the movie Wolf of Wall Street and just say, you know, if you want to be empowered, just get out there. Just go do it. Don't worry about, you know, being on your feet for 18 hours in a row or you're being pregnant and having your child exposed to dangerous chemicals that cause birth defects. Just do it.
Yeah, and that means actually that there's something wrong with you, right? Because clearly you have then, you know, failed to actually use your potential. This is, I think, to me, is the most problematic issue about this, or sort of implication, is that like it's clear that it's a ridiculous idea that if girls just believe in themselves and if they have the liberty again to work, that will automatically empower them. But what to me is even worse is that with these women that I met, like you're essentially saying like, well, you did something wrong because you aren't supposed to need anything. You aren't supposed to need any protections or good labor standards. You are supposed to be able to do this all by yourself because you are the most powerful person in the world.
That's the weirdest thing about it, I feel like, is that sort of technocratic point of view is usually brought to us with just asinine data that isn't even true. But this one is so pernicious and awful because it's like telling the poorest, most exploited people on earth, no, you're the problem. You don't believe in yourself.
Now, you know, exactly. Nike says that it has this quote code of conduct, and they said they send inspectors to these factories to monitor the working conditions and see if they are, you know, in compliance with this code. Now, what does the Nike code of conduct for the people who work in these factories entail?
So, they have minimum age standards. So for some work that is 16, for most jobs it's 18. Harassment is forbidden.
What? That's bullshit.
Yeah, no, yeah. We need to get these.
I was gonna give my application. Now, fuck it.
We need to get these factories out of there for that reason alone.
Well, Maria, I mean, like at one point, you spoke to one woman who is pregnant and still working all the time. He says if you're pregnant, your hours are cut back. You can work 7 hours a day, but the quotas remain the same.
Yeah.
So you still have to produce, like, so you're just working twice as hard in the less amount of time that you have. And that you spoke to, there was one woman who was pregnant and is still working in the part of the manufacturing process that involves these glues.
Yeah, that's the same woman,
you breathe
actually.
In a lot of the fumes of these glue. Yeah.
Yes. So I mean, she's the only person that I spoke to who told me about this. But then when I asked the Workers' Rights Consortium, who I quote quite extensively in the article, according to them, this is quite common. Yeah. And so her story was particularly awful because as you just brought up, like, she worked in like the gluing section, so she had the opportunity to work to move to a different section because she was very worried about the health effects and particularly for her baby, and she said, she's like, everybody knows this is bad for you, so this to her this was sort of like a comment, like she knew that she was risking the health of her baby, but then if she would take that other job, she she would lose, I think, $9 a month, something like that, because it is like the hazardous work bonus. So she couldn't afford to lose it. So she just stayed there. Yeah.
I mean, to quote one of my favorite Instagram accounts, Success Motivation Lifestyle, it's a baby, not an excuse. Grind.
I mean, you know, and this gets to, I think, the heart of why this whole girl effect, at least as it's invoked by a corporation like Nike. And then there's a lot of other people who are backing this too, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, yeah, and a lot of these huge, you know, charitable NGO organizations, is that it's all about, like, it says all the right things, but the one thing it doesn't say anything about is what constitutes a living wage. And the example of the woman who's pregnant and still has to, you know, do the job for the $9 extra, it just seems like, how is the girl effect supposed to work when the wages you get working these jobs just basically sustain you enough to keep working the job and living in a house, like, you know, or paying rent and eating food, but it gives you nothing in terms of, like, saving money, or where is the money going to come from to invest in these back in her family or communities, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same with entrepreneurship, with the idea of entrepreneurship, right? Like, there's no talk about sort of social safety nets. And if you ask Nike about it, they will call it complex.
Well, here's what they said. Yeah, actually, I have that quote right in front of me because it's nauseating. I'm quoting from the article now. You say, Nike's Sustainable Business and Corporate Responsibility Reports the past 12 years acknowledge that some workers' rights organizations are calling for higher wages, and that, quote, some workers feel that they are not fairly compensated in return for their work, and this can lead to a lack of morale, low self-esteem, and reduced productivity. God forbid they reduce productivity. But in a 2010 email to Viet Labor, Hannah Jones, Nike's vice president for what at the time was called Sustainable Business and Innovation, and now sits atop the board of directors of the Nike Foundation and is a mentor in the Girl Effect program, wrote that while there is no accepted definition for a living wage, and she called it, quote, a complex debate, local wage setting is best done by negotiations between workers, labor representatives, the employer, and the government. This is her quote on that. Why is that a disingenuous thing to say about Vietnam in particular?
They have been involved in these conversations with Nike, like, for many times, and different brands, and this is like a thing that comes up a lot, and that is particularly in the context of Vietnam very pertinent. Like, there's one government union, there is one, like, legally allowed union, and it's controlled by the government. And many of the management of factories, they are officially, like, union representatives. So that would mean that negotiations, and this is, I've heard this for different factories, so I'm sure it doesn't apply to every factory, but I've heard it like a couple of times, is that after it would mean that factory management would be negotiating with themselves, and that's, of course, is not really going to benefit workers. So they cannot organize themselves.
And what I find so revolting about the statement about, you know, it's a complex issue, is that, as you point out, it's not complicated at all. It's very, very easy to tally up what would constitute a living wage. And as you say, a living wage would be about three times what these women are currently making. You say about $160 a week. And to, like, have that empowering effect, it would need to be around $500.
Yeah, yeah.
So $160 a month.
And the thing is, They have control. So if you will go through these CSR reports, which I do not recommend, but I've done it, and, like, they will blame problems on like a whole host of things, from, like, that the managers aren't culturally sensitive, or, you know, the solutions that they come up with for complaints about harassment and high work pressure and low wages is, well, we'll, you know, let's dig into this, and it's a learning process, and all kinds of sort of, like, distractions. But yes, like you say, it is very simple. Like a living wage, it's easy to calculate. I asked the women themselves, I was surprised by how sort of consistent their answers were. Like the range that they said they would need. A living wage. I mean, I do have to say that there are different definitions for it, right? So for me, I asked them, so what would you need to? How much would you have to earn to raise two children and, you know, save a little bit of money for unexpected expenses, because this was a major concern for all of them. Is that when somebody gets sick, first of all, they don't have time to go to like public hospitals, because they work between like 48 and 54 hours a week in these factories. So they'll often have to go to private clinics, and they simply don't have the money. There were like a few women from two different factories who told me that their managers had complained about the fact that Nike, that their purchasing price hadn't kept pace with their rising costs. So Vietnam has actually been raising their minimum wage quite a bit over the past years. And they said that this was an excuse that their managers had used for like cutting down staff and increasing their work pressures. Like, well, you know, if Nike would pay us more, if keep up with our expenses, you know, we wouldn't have this problem. So who knows, maybe this was just their way of defending it, but I thought it was interesting enough to take a closer look at. But Nike wouldn't let me talk to their managers about this topic, even when the Vietnamese Labor Department sent them a letter asking them specifically if I could ask this question to some factory managers on their prices.
This is interesting to me because Felix alluded to it earlier, but like, you know, the Matt Iglesias line that different countries have different labor standards and that's okay. And the idea being that, like, well, laxer labor laws are essentially what a country like Vietnam can offer a mega corporation like Nike. And the net effect is, you know, economic growth, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But to what extent is Nike not even following Vietnam's labor laws?
Right.
Are they adhering to them?
No. Well, first they make it hard, right, for the government to even raise the wages higher, because what is it that they've always done? Why is this called a race to the bottom? Like, if their wages will go up too high, like, they will go somewhere else. And so in that way, and this is what labor rights experts like in that region will, some of them also told me, it's like, well, they have so much power, like, it's they make it pretty hard for the government to raise wages. But when it comes to like the harassment in these factories, there were different standards that were violated that where Vietnam's labor law was indeed like violated.
So I mean, one of the big things that I remember from the one of the things that really stuck out to me was when you talked about the 32-year-old woman. I mean, we've talked about her before in this interview, but the 32-year-old woman who was pregnant and working on this floor with just horrific chemicals and terrified that her child would be born with birth defects because, you know, there's no other option for her. So was that in violation of any Vietnamese labor laws?
No, because she had the option, right? Like, she had the option to go to that other department. But yes, no, it was a violation that her quotas went up during according to the law. Like, the law dictates that her daily hours were reduced from 8 to 7. So the company like adhered to that. But by leaving her quota the same, which, as you pointed out earlier, which brought up the pressure, that is not allowed. So that was a violation. Yeah,
it's very interesting how you know, in all these countries where you know, just out of the goodness of their hearts, these people just want to give girls an opportunity, that they also don't seem to enforce labor laws that much. Just a weird confluence of of events.
I will show you how have a path with great bitterness here. It's called Puru, 8 years old dog. And I'm going to show how to swim with Puru. Come along, Puru, here. Come along. Puru, come along. please, Peru. This is not right. Peru, this is good. Oh, shit. Oh, don't go, please. Puppy has a bat. So, how we bat coordinate dogs?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview your background is in global development, and particularly as it relates to girls and women.
These globalists.
So what would, like, in your opinion, what would, like, an actual girl effect campaign, like, you know, if we wanted to actually empower women in, let's say, rural Vietnam, what would that look like vis-a-vis the United States or a company like Nike?
Experts have different ideas on this. Like, some say, well, you know, you, and they have different calculations. Like, if you would raise the price of, you know, a pair of sneakers with $1, you would be there. Or some say that's not even necessary. Like, they, you know, they
yeah, you know how easily... much a pair of Jordans cost? God damn.
Exactly.
Well, we've gone longer than I thought I would, but I'm glad we did, because I want to give justice, you know, do justice to the piece you wrote. I mean, in closing, when you were, you know, in the factories, were talking to Nike, did they give you a chance to get any of the exclusive lime green Dunk Lows or Cross Trainer Air Max 93
foam posits?
That's right. I took two suitcases, and it's exactly as they said. They're comfortable and stylish. Yeah.
Yeah, the Jordan 7s still got to be the most classic basketball sneaker of all time, though, right?
In the past few years, we've found that a lot of the NGOs that we thought were just selfless, altruistic do-gooders in our world are, you know, about as compromised as the rest of us. What was your interaction with, like, these NGOs that sort of pushed this agenda? Did you find them to be just sort of wholesale corporate astroturfing outfits, or filled with people who actually believe this stuff but are paid to disseminate it?
That's a very good question, actually. So I found that it differed. I actually interviewed more organizations, also for, like, another project for a Dutch newspaper last year. So I've spoken to a fair amount of NGOs, and like, the best response I got was from, it's like a children's rights organization, from, like, a fairly junior woman who worked there, who literally told me, when we were talking about the girl effect, who literally told me, like, well, if, for both girls and women, she said, if you can just sort of get them out of the house once a week, you know, get them out of their isolation, you make sure that they have, like, a social group to go to, like, once a week, this will really change everything. And what she meant, I mean, I'm assuming, is, like, this, because this was a girl effect a project she was talking about, is that this is what will help them get out of poverty. So I would ask her, like how exactly does that work? And for me, and she didn't have an answer to that, but she was very well intended, and she actually literally told me, she's like, I only realize now that I can't say anything negative about Nike, and that is a problem, but, you know, I'm part of, like, a bigger organization. Jesus. I have a boss above me.
Holy shit.
Oh, yes, God. But this is the best response. This is the most sort of genuine response I got. Like, when I talked to, like, a larger women's rights organization, it's the International Center for Research of Women. They also work with Goldman Sachs. Like, they evaluate their women's empowerment. I wrote another article.
I've been interning at the women's at the International Center for Researching Women. I interned there.
That's gonna replace the female body inspector T-shirt.
But they didn't want to say anything about it. And they didn't know they would get questions about this. And when I reached out and said, I just, you know, I would like to talk to you about the girl effect. And they were all very keen to do it. But the minute the Nike question came up, like, how do you think this extends to the women in their factories? Most of them would just say, like, I can't comment on it. This is my area is not labor rights.
I feel like we have shills today and AstroTurf campaigns, they're lazier than ever. You know, I feel like, you know, if I was running an AstroTurf campaign or a PSYOP or, you know, any number of those things, if someone asked me about the direct thing that I'm trying to cover up, I would have an answer prepared. And I think we need to outsource these shill jobs to places like Malaysia, Vietnam, etc., because these people just aren't cutting it anymore.
But I also think, and I do really want to mention this, is that for many NGOs, like, it is becoming very, very hard to just survive without either without corporate funding or without being at least positive towards the development narratives that these corporations are spreading. Most funding comes from the private sector, and corporations have been taking up a larger role there. And again, it's more rhetoric than real. If you look at Goldman Sachs and Nike, if you read their materials, you think that they are literally, they have resources for every girls NGO in the world. No, I've been through all their text forms. They invest most of their stuff in either their own little programs or in like media campaigns to just spread their narrative.
I mean, it's depressing and it's hard to think of a way out of it, but like, I, as Felix mentioned, I can only hope that in about 3, 4, maybe 5 years time, all of the jobs at Vox will be outsourced to Vietnamese teenagers.
So to close out, I mean, this is the problem we seem to run into, or, you know, the final talking point, the break this glass when you're getting beat in this argument that people who believe this sort of shit throw at you is, well, what's the way out? You know, how do we stop doing this? What's a better solution? So talking to the people you talked to and seeing what you saw over there, do you think there are, you know, what do you see ameliorating this? Like, do you think there could be labor movements in these countries? Do you think it would be pressure on these companies to adhere to better standards, or a combination of these things?
Well, of course, if you're going to keep rewarding a country like Vietnam with like a third of your produce, like Nike does, like that's not really an incentive to any any country to go far beyond it. I think it's on the Dominican Republic. It's supposed to be like the only, no, it's not good sweatshop, it's like the responsible like apparel factory that like pays their workers living wages, which in that context is also like 3 times as much. The workers, like, they have their own like union. They have independent inspectors, and that's sort of like a model of how it could be. Like, it shows that like it can be done. Like, you don't need like a sweatshop model, but of course it's harder for them to compete with, you know, with others who are going to have practices like such as Nike.
The weird thing about all of this is, so their argument is that you sort of need this brutal spur of development in these countries, like that they're doing this to help these places, but you kind of think that, well, if they're successful, they're just going to leave those countries and go to the next place, and they'll just be on an unending campaign of moving their factories to worse and worse places until they
race to the bottom.
You know, maybe by 2070 they'll have put in factory in Antarctica, and we'll be close to running out of countries that can fuck up.
But this is exactly what is happening, and what currently like is allowed by the international trade system, right? An international economic system.
Or it's just like, there's also this idea that, like, well, you know, if these girls and women, you know, what would they be doing if they weren't taking part in a wage economy or whatever? And it's just like, well, gee, I don't know what Southeast Asia was doing for the last 3,000 years, but all this is pretty relative. This is relatively new. Like, global capitalism is kind of, you know, it's not on the grand scale of history, is pretty new.
I mean, we could always send Charles Murray back there.
That's true.
To close out, Maria, thank you so much. We're going to put the link up to the article in the episode description.
Thank you.
But in respect of our friend Ron Fournier, all on the count of three, let's say it. 1, 2, 3. Both sides do it.
Just do it. Both sides just do it.
Hell yeah.
Just do it. Both.
Love that factory.
Maria, thanks again for talking to us and for writing the article.
Thank you so much.
Brendan has already edited out the part where I called Vietnam China Junior.
We are back. again. Hope you all enjoyed that interview with Maria Hengeveld. The article was on slate.com. We will link to it in the show information. Moving on from a serious topic to far less serious. I think it sort of lines up nicely because we want to talk about sort of two sides of the same coin. And that coin is the right wing in America. At the moment, we want to talk about the alt-right and then a new side that we've discovered that's even more angry, resentful, and awful than the alt-right. And we're going to dub that the elevator right for reasons that we will explain shortly. I guess, like, by way of introducing what I want to talk about the alt-right, I want to give sort of a preface, because I feel like a little bit bashful talking about this, because I always worry that when you bring them up and talk about it, like, it's elevating their importance or stature in some way. And, like, I want to avoid the trap of talking about them like they are, you know, the cutting edge of the Fourth Reich in America, because they definitely aren't. I'm just interested in them because I think they're the only really funny character left in the election. I know we've talked before about how the election got depressing as soon as the candidates were locked in, but I don't know. The alt-right thing continues to be amusing for me for a couple reasons that I hope we can discuss. I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
I don't know. I've said my thoughts on the alt-right before. It's not the huge moral panic and new thing that people make it out to be, where 40-year-old journalists writing articles about getting pictures of ovens and shit. I mean, this is just the internet that I've seen forever. Like, if you played Counter-Strike or Unreal Tournament, like, yeah, this is what people do online. I don't think it's either a, like, viable political movement nor some grave moral panic.
Well, they're all the kids who have spent years online trolling each other into prodromal schizophrenia, who, thanks to this election, have a chance to sort of export their trolling into the wider political discourse. And because the people who they're interacting with are, for the most part, coddled diaper babies from the Beltway who aren't used to that kind of thing, they really are acting like they're, you know, uncovering a fucking Dachau or something, when you're really talking about a bunch of sad 15-year-olds.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I really question how many of them are actually old enough to vote at this point.
I mean, maybe half, and that's so probably being generous.
I mean, here's the divide I see in the alt-right. It's like a bunch of 15-year-olds who are named, like, you know, like, fucking triggering Trump, and their bios are like shitlord, shitposter, make America great, blah 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 blah. And it's like, you know, they're like sending frogs to Michael Barbaro and Ben Howe, which, like, I don't care if you, like, that's funny if you do that. And then the people who are older, who are legally old to vote, those are the guys who are named like Saxon Wrath and like the return of masculinity, and they're the guys who make YouTube videos that get like 72 views. And they're like, why Lena Dunham is a rapist or something. And they're like, YouTube is censoring me because they're hiding all the views.
Well, enough of our speculation on who and what the alt-right is and means. Let's go to the horse's mouth themselves. There are sort of, I picked out two articles that I think encapsulate this phenomenon very accurately. And now the first one is an article that was run in the Jewish Daily Forward this past week, the title of which is "I'm a Jew and I'm a member of the alt-right." This is an article by a guy named Joshua Seidel.
Did I just blow your mind?
And he's writing in sort of the most famous American Jewish newspaper about why he, a Jewish American, associates himself with a movement whose sort of primary association is with neo-Nazis, basically, or they're sort of wannabe neo-Nazis, I guess is how I would describe them. But let's hear what Joshua has to say about this. I'm reading from his article now. He says, "I enjoy the nasty talk in the alt-right. I enjoy spending rhetorical time with people who might otherwise hate me. The alt-right has energy, it has vitality, it's something new and creative. It's honest and forthright. What I like about that line about how the alt-right has energy and creativity is I think it's exactly what Henry Ford said about Germany in the 1930s. But yeah, he enjoys spending rhetorical time among people who might otherwise hate him. He says, "I have a thick skin and a tolerance for others. Liberals like to imagine themselves as, quote, tolerant, but real tolerance is the ability to be around people who are different than you and still value them as people." Can you begin to see where this article goes off the rails?
Yeah, I love that. That's the best shit on earth. It's like, so you don't want me to walk around in a fucking Nazi armband and talk about how much I want you to and all of your family members to die horribly in a concentration camp? Wow, way to be tolerant.
Wow.
Nice open mind you have.
It occurs to me that if liberals were so tolerant, I would have any friends at all.
I mean, Matt, you're exactly right. It goes on, and it's like the typical Kant where he says, college was an awakening for me, and like, but PC and blah, 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 and I'm sick of being called racist just because I recognize the truth of skull shape and IQ data. But he goes on like this, but, he also says the Trayvon Martin case was his eye-opening moment. That was his road to Damascus moment on his road to becoming
an... Yeah, because, like, I think that the subsequent experiences of George Zimmerman, where he's basically been in a nonstop carnival of domestic assault and public violence, has really undermined the argument that he had murdered Trayvon Martin.
He quotes friend of the show Ricky Vaughn in this piece by sort of as a means of saying, well, as a Jew, certainly many on the alt-right hate Jews, but they're actually better for us than liberals and leftists and Sharia law. The mistake that poor Joshua made in this piece was the idea that the alt-right cares about tolerance at all, because the real turn in this piece was in the comment sections to it, where, of course, everyone who's actually on the alt-right showed up to tell him to die in an oven and that they want nothing to do with him, and that in no way could any Jew ever be a member of the alt-right. And it led to this hilarious sequence of tweets. Joshua says, in response to, again, all of these people who told him he should go to Israel or just die, like they want to cleanse America of all Jewry and all... This is Josh's response to this was, for those genuine white nationalists who feel I am not part of the alt-right, I understand and don't want to argue over terms. He continues, he says, keep in mind that the quote term member on the Jewish Daily Forward article wasn't chosen by me. I would have said supporter. So from here on in, I will no longer call myself alt-right, as in the same way you are. I am a right-wing Jew who agrees with most of what you say.
It's so funny that he is attaching himself Remora-like to the alt-right, because this dude is the biggest fucking fuck.
Such a fucking pussy.
This is the most... This guy makes Jeb Bush look like Dan Bilzerian. Yeah. This is the most cucked man on...
Yeah, dude, he's like what, like, alt-right people are like, I saw somebody in a headscarf today. And he's like, first of all, what the fuck? Second of all, are you alright? DM me if you need anything.
Well, this is what I love about this, is that the alt-right has moved into their ally phase. So now they have allies who are like, I am here to listen and amplify the voices of white nationalists.
He's the worst. He is fucking eternally wandering Joshua. Go fuck yourself. What a fucking cuck.
I'm sorry. It's just, I really like talking about IQ and the bell curve. Just please let me do that. Please, if you don't mind, just please, no talk about the ovens today. Can we just talk about focus on the blacks for a minute, please?
Ooh, Heinrich Mimler. I agree with you that 6 million is a high number, but I'm just trying to support you guys.
The next article I want to talk about is something that ran in the Daily Caller this week. Is an opinion piece, the title of which was, "Who is Pepe, really?" And this is by a guy who writes under the name Henry Dampier, which I hope...
Oh, that fucking...
Is that
which I hope, for his sake, is a pseudonym.
I would Henry say that that's Arthur Chu's pen name. Arthur Henry Damper.
He's probably named after some antebellum slavery apologist who died of six types of syphilis.
No, he's one of these guys who, like... he's one of these pricks who, their avatar is, like, an oil painting of a man with, like, a powdered wig scowling. Yeah, sorry. His Twitter bio here says, "For hierarchy, against equality. Editor at Social Matter, fellow at Hestia Society," whatever the fuck that is. Probably
that sounds real. That sounds like a real thing.
Yeah.
That sounds like a very real thing.
They have a mailbox.
Yeah, I study at the Institute for Thracian Return. It's in the strip mall.
Well, I'm actually on the Hestia Society website right now, and it's basically a fucking blog.
Yeah. Do you think they have a sex room like another blog we know, Talking Points Memo? Like, there's a Hestia Society fuck room.
Okay, Henry Dampier writes, "With Hillary Clinton's speech accusing Donald Trump of associating with the alternative right on Thursday, the commentariat has worked itself into a foam over what it all means. Who is Pepe? Are memes real? Why is Harry Potter a Nazi now?" I don't know what he's talking about. "I don't know. Conventional Republicans feel that the ground has shifted from under them." He's right about that. And he, but he goes, "What caused that?" He says, "When you actually meet the people who live behind the internet masks, you'll often find ordinary middle-class Americans." Okay, no, yeah. You won't. No, you won't.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about Trump supporters, if you're talking about people who are going to vote for Trump or go to his rallies, yes. If you're talking about the assholes who have, like, yeah, like Himmler, fucking Pepe, fucking Super Mario, that person is not an ordinary middle-class American.
He says, quote, "These are the normies who have become weird. What provoked them? Why didn't they get all on the Jeb campaign bus? Any attempt at providing a full answer would be inaccurate. So instead, let's focus on something important that we can grasp. The conventional Republican story about America isn't relevant to ordinary people anymore."
True.
"If the alt-right and Donald Trump's campaign has real impotence, it's the widespread realization that you can't assimilate tens or hundreds of millions of foreign immigrants to a host culture that's in decline." Okay, I'll stop you there again. I agree with Henry that I don't think America could assimilate hundreds of millions of immigrants.
Yeah, don't you?
No, that would be really difficult. Since we only have 300-some million people in America,
if our country,
adding a third of the U.S. population in a short period of time would be too many.
How many Syrian refugees have actually been settled in America? Like
2 billion.
Like
2 billion.
Less than 10,000.
2 billion. If you uncock the immigration numbers, okay, so they say there's been 10,000. Well, how many kids, like, so a lot of people don't know this, but Syrians are like nesting dolls, and they hide their kids underneath their skins. It's not racist. Arabs can pull apart like Russian nesting dolls. It's just science.
And let's not forget that every Syrian immigrant can reproduce by budding.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
So you're talking about, yeah, like an exponential growth.
And the Democrats are openly campaigning on this. Like, you guys saw Hillary when she was making this speech from an iron lung, which the media won't talk about, like, why she's in an iron lung. But she, like, once they shot her full of an EpiPen so her heart could beat long enough for her to talk, she was like, 300 million! Is all right, but 500 million is three's company.
And Henry Damp goes on that, of course, the left wants all these immigrants because they know they'll vote for Democrats, blah, blah, blah. But then, and you know, he, and then he asks the question, why did white identity politics come back? This is where it gets really good. He says, why has white identity politics suddenly emerged as a nationally important issue? Well, let's put forward a little thought experiment. Let's say that you just started your prison sentence.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You have no friends in prison. Maybe You were a little...
Yeah, in prison. I had a lot of friends outside of prison, just so everybody knows.
Yeah, all my friends are in the place in the regular world, including my girlfriend.
All my friends live in Canada, unfortunately. Yeah. But he says, you have no friends in prison. Maybe you are a little chubby or you have a squeaky voice. So let's just imagine this first. Henry's just throwing out a thought experiment where you have no friends.
Hypothetical.
You get sent to prison and you're also a chubby, squeaky little bitch. Okay, so pretty much you're fucked. Okay.
Let's do a thought experiment here. Let's do a thought experiment here. You have no friends. You're a pussy. You got a boner when you hugged your hot cousin.
You got sent to jail for that.
You're a loser.
So imagine your first day on the yard. And he said, Henry writes, this prison is run by various gangs. These gangs don't look like the Hollywood multiracial rainbow gangs. Most of these gangs take race very seriously and not in an academic way. So yeah, Charles Murray isn't a gang leader in prison, is what he's trying to say. But he says, let's say that you check the white box on the census. You may want to say that you were part Irish American with an Italian grandmother, but as far as the prison population is concerned, your options for gang membership are limited. If you want to avoid being stabbed at the cafeteria, whose table do you go sit at? Do you try to join up with the Bloods, or do you join the Aryan Nations? Or do you decide...
Henry, I got some bad news for you. You're going to get stabbed in the bathroom no matter what. The first time you're like, so, gentlemen, has any of you read Joseph de Maistre? You're going to get air-holed to death. Yeah. So it doesn't really
matter. Imagine this guy going up to J.K. Simmons and Oz and being like, we find ourselves sitting athwart history and yelling, stop.
Now, he qualifies this by saying, now, America isn't quite an open-air prison. Oh, I'm glad you admitted that.
Yeah. But
what he's trying to say in this article is, who is the alt-right? Who are the Pepes? Well, what he's saying, if you imagine America as a giant prison, they're the white people in that prison. And then essentially, for protection, white people will have to join the alt-right. But I don't know.
Wait a
what
minute. So he's saying that he's like the fucking tatted up shock collar? Because that's insane. These guys are the dudes who get fucking like sold for cigarettes and ramen packets.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
I don't
these
know
guys
what
are fetishizing like a state of nature where like racial truths are what power everything. And they think that they're fucking nerdy, asthmatic asses are going to thrive just because of racial solidarity. They think they're not going to get ground into paste by some like power worshipping tribal dynamic. Like, that's the fantasy these dipshits have, is like, well, you know, yes, some might be stronger and more physically imposing, but my knowledge of all of the relevant animes will allow me to be his consigliere. No, you're going to get fucking turned inside out and made into a fucking fuck puppy.
I can't be the only guy.
That's why we have society. That's why you're able to go online and do your fucking Pepe bullshit. It's because we've all decided we're not going to do that. And the thing that you're so horrified by, this multiracial experiment in shitty democracy or whatever you want to call it, that's the only reason that you are not a fucking fuck toy for some gang leader or something.
Guys.
And you're going to pine for that. You're going to pine for a reality that would see you just destroyed instantly for being too weak to compete.
I can't be the only one who thinks that if 10,000 14-year-olds with asthma and clinical depression got together, that they could form a gang that would defend the white race and dominate all the other gangs.
Like the white dudes in prison who are like AB members, I don't think they think of like regular bitch-made white people as white. Like, I really don't think they would let you join their gang.
Imagine that conversation. Like, yeah, so how did you get into the Aryan Brotherhood? Well, I started out posting on /poll. I joined Twitter.
But, no, Matt, you get to exactly the right point. Henry Damp's bio says that he's for hierarchy and against equality. I will posit that any of these fucking dorks, if you were to put them in charge of society and give them absolute authority to sort of re-engineer the hierarchy of American society to their exact specifications, they would still end up on the bottom of it.
Yeah. Exactly. Like some fucking thick-necked mongoloid, like that tatted psycho screaming at people in that Trump video from Arizona. Yeah. They just like fucking rip their heads off and just be like, I'm in charge now. And then they would wipe their ass with all of the pages of all of the neo-reactionary texts that they have compiled that they were going to like use as inspiration for the new society.
Sorry, one last thing. Actually, I did check out Henry Damp's blog, and he wrote an article following up on this. I just want to quote his last line. He says, "People both accused me of being a Nazi and being insufficiently respectful of Hitler's record in the same timeline. That's sort of to be expected when you try to be a neutral arbiter when neither side wants arbitration."
Holy shit. So if
he's the Ron Fournier of the Fourth Reich.
Yeah, dude. If Arthur Chu, that we just read from Arthur Chu, this is Ron. This is, he's like, he's talking about the Applebee's Third Reich.
And no, he did
love
say
that white boy.
He's like, I just want to sit down at the table with the AB and have a beer with them.
I just want to sit down and have some Prudhomme.
What?
And then hopefully they will not, they will not hollow me out.
Well,
no, his idea of what jail is like, he must have just watched The Night Of. I don't know if you've been watching that show, but when that kid goes to jail, Michael K. Williams is like, I'm taking you under my wing, kid, because you're smart and have read books. And like you're interesting to me, so I want to be friends with you. It's like, sorry, that's not how prison works.
No, not at all. Not at all. There's going to be a lot of gaping sacks and O-rings if this goes down.
I think you had a good point. You had a good point about like that. I think the bottom line on the alt-right is that we said they're like the same online degenerates that have like sort of always existed, but now they have sort of a politics, but it's the same idea that they're just sort of externalizing their own self-loathing and perversion, basically.
Well, the degree to which these guys, like what they think of as a cuck, like what the traits that they find abhorrent, most specifically in like their fellow whites who don't have the solidarity that they do with the white race. It's all the shit that they worry about themselves. I mean, why is their chief terror being cucked? You know, why is that the worst thing that could happen? Like, because they are absolutely certain in their deep heart that they couldn't fucking satisfy a woman if they had a goddamn dick transplant.
Yeah, and I think this is
they have no chance of doing it, and so they're terrified of their own inadequacy.
Or like when they sort of intone darkly about like white demographic decline is because they know, again, in their heart of hearts that they're never going to have children.
Yeah, it's not in a half.
Never going to reproduce.
Yeah, it's like someone like argued about it. Someone like said that to Liam, like, in my mentions the other day, where they're like, huh, I wonder what group is responsible for the decline of whites as a population. And I thought, like, I don't know, you? Like, you who no one wants to fuck?
Yeah. I had a dude...
could never fucking reproduce.
I got into it with a dude this week who was just like, so what was wrong with Hitler? Just asking questions.
Oh, that
he got you.
That guy was awesome because he wanted to do like, well, let's have a reasoned debate about the Nazis. It's like, that's the entire point of fascism, is that you don't have to have debates. You have tanks and gas chambers. You fucking
These are like West Wing fascists.
The entire point of fascism is that it buries the putrid corpse of liberty, as Mussolini said, and banishes all of the sad bickering that makes up our attempt at a political discourse.
And like the way
and replaces it with naked force.
The way you can tell that like most of these guys are just teenagers is because like when they try to wind people up or quote unquote debate them, you sort of get the feeling that they always think that they're talking to like their stereotype of like a Tumblr teenager, and they're like, oh, did I trigger you, bitch? Get in the oven or whatever. Because that kind of kid is their peer group, and that's who they think they're debating. And Matt, as you've quite rightly pointed out, the worst thing you can do to one of these people is just take them seriously.
And the thing is, like, they hate these Tumblr teens, but those are the only people who freak out about their like incredibly lame super stale attempts at being shocking.
Yeah, it's like the Milo thing, you know?
Well, that media members.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the other thing, is that they can do this to lanyards, and lanyards will freak out because they think of Twitter as, like, their workplace, and a guy coming in saying, fuck you, go to the ovens, is like somebody coming into their break room and saying it to them, and they have the same reaction. Yeah. But for people who are used to being on the internet and are on there for their own enjoyment, like, they've seen that shit, like, 5 minutes after they logged on the first time. It doesn't mean anything to them. The only people are, yeah, those media people, and then these, like, incredibly fragile Tumblr teens who have about the same level of tea as these fucking people do. And it's just like a flip of the coin that they turned out that way instead of as Tumblr teens. And so that anxiety, it's like the thing they need them to react so that they can feel like they're having an effect. And they're also super terrified of being like that because they know, yeah, they're peers. They're the demographic peers.
So basically, I think this is why nobody should really fear the alt-right, because, like, these people are not brown shirts, you know?
No. No, it's like the two reasons we don't have to worry too much is because there's broadly two types of Trump supporter. There's the guys who actually are in the streets, the ones who go to the rallies, the ones who vote. And as we've discussed,
they're about 70 years old.
Fat. They're old and they're fat. And they need the jazzy scooter to get across town.
Yeah,
and
the other ones are these
frail 12-year-olds. That is not how you create a stormtrooper. Neither way. You need, like, the guys who created the SA were, like, young, basically incredibly battle-scarred World War I veterans. And these guys are all, like, on the wrong end, either end of the demographic curve to be any kind of threat to anybody.
You don't create an SA with 10 million Hermann Gerings. Yeah. Like, who are the only people in the streets.
So, yeah, that's the alt-right. But the other thing that we discovered this week is that we, us three personally, are as bad as them. And that's what I want to
talk about. Yeah, we're pretty bad. We're sorry, guys.
That's what I want to talk about now. Because, we are basically morally on par with the type of people who think the Holocaust either didn't happen or did happen and was extremely good. And this all got started because of elevators. What do we go back to?
Start with elevators.
Trains and elevators, folks. Where do we begin with this one? This started earlier this week when our producer, Brendan, just put out a call. He said, will somebody pay me to write an article about the phenomenon of conservative snack men getting trapped in elevators and trains? Now, he's referring to something that we've referenced on the show before, about the penchant for a certain type of conservative to literally find themselves trapped in elevators and then tweet about it. It happened most famously to Sonny Bunch. He got trapped in an elevator at Home Depot and had to be rescued by the fire department. And in my personal favorite, John Podhoretz got trapped on the monorail at Disney World.
Unbelievable. Unprecedented. That is, like, high level.
Possibly one of the funniest things imaginable.
Best examples of oafery of all time.
Do you think when they got him out, they, like, mistook him for a Berenstain Bear and they were like, get back to work?
No, it's one of the country bears.
Right now.
They thought one of the animatronic country bears had gotten loose.
They're like, that's all right, good, great. You should take off the hat. Good. You get double overtime for this.
John. You can't traumatize these kids. Keep blowing into that a jug with triple X on it.
Do you think that John Podhoretz is like an operator and has like a goldfish and like Oreos sewed into the inside of his coat pockets for like times he gets trapped? He's like, I could get trapped at any moment.
Well, I'm thinking like just leaving like a trail of treats. And then just leading him into an elevator shaft, having to just walk into an empty elevator shaft.
Yeah, you could take care. You could take out like half of the useless nepotism cases at right wing welfare media organizations with that very strategy.
But yeah, dude, Trump could have wiped out Never Trump by just like inviting them all to a meeting on an elevator in Trump Tower.
But that's the important point, is that this specific type of person is all the Never Trumps, right? These are all the Never Trump conservatives.
Yeah.
And I think they should be called elevators. You know, because we're the alt left now, and like, you know, the alt right, they have their own slang, cuck. And but like, let's have our own. Let's just call them elevator boys. So the good news is that I think Brendan, someone is going to pay him to write this article, like, you know, Fusion or the Daily Thought Catalog or something like that. But in any case, he tweeted something along the lines of, like, if you hold opinion A, chances are this has also happened to, or like, tweet A is indicative of tweet B, and tweet A was Sonny Bunch going, God, wouldn't it have been great if the GOP had nominated someone who was serious about border security who could get elected? Oh, well. And then tweet B was Sonny going, spending Saturday in the elevator at Home Depot. Please send help.
Why was Sonny even at Home Depot? He doesn't know how to fix anything. I mean, I know that Home Depot, like, keeps snacks near the front. But it's like, you could have just, like, he could have just gone to, like, fucking Walgreens and gotten snacks.
He was trying to get an extra large toilet seat.
Oh, yeah, he's kind
of, he was at that Home Depot that has cheesesteaks.
Yeah, he was in Philadelphia.
So, one of Sonny's colleagues at the Free Beacon caught on to this and replied to Brendan with, oh, real funny when a liberal hears immigration and the first thing they think of is Home Depot. You know, real tolerant, buddy. And Brendan had to inform him that the joke was, in fact, not about picking up day laborers at Home Depot, but Sonny being trapped in Home Depot.
And he's like, oh, wow, then, yeah, so I'm supposed to know that? Okay, cool.
And then something beautiful happened, because...
Yes, gorgeous.
In this thread... Some brilliant person who follows us, I forget who you are, but if you're out there, thank you so much, did a tweet search and found that this guy, whose name is like FBI Bill or something, literally tweeted that he too had been trapped in an elevator. Yeah, this is like stuck in the... No, but no, I skipped the best part. His FBI Bill McMorris's tweet was, trapped in an elevator again. So this is a repeat occurrence. Have you, like, first of all, I've never been trapped in an elevator.
Never.
I've never That's been not never happened anyone to that me. Happening to anyone.
That's never
I have an elevator in my building. I'm in an elevator every single day, and I've never been trapped in an elevator.
I've been using elevators my entire life. I've never been caught in one.
Yeah.
But apparently, if you write for the Free Beacon, this is a regular occurrence for you.
Yeah, if you've ever lamented about hookup culture, that elevator is going to be failing you at least 20% of the times you try it. I don't know why it is. It's just... you know, there are some things that science can't explain because they're too beautiful and they're part of the wonders of life.
Did you guys also... I did look into F. Bill McMorris, and he's a guy who looks like he extremely identifies with Marco Rubio. Like, that's how I would describe him. Like, he feels a kinship with Marco, like, on a deep level. That's how, kind of how I describe him. But yes. I was going to say, he's another one of these dorks that has photos of his kids and his Twitter avi, like human shields to, like, no, don't own me. Look at my beautiful kids.
Yeah, I mean, to quote Golda Meir, the worst thing these people do is make us own their kids. But Bill McMorris has, like, a very classic conservative look, which is ham-faced pussy who looks terrified and on the verge of tears at all times. Just Google Bill McMorris and see if he doesn't look like he's about to cry in every fucking picture.
In any case, we had a lot of fun... Again, merely just joking about the fact that they've been caught in elevators before, and that he blundered into, like, this... He just walked into this beautifully. So we spent, you know, a couple hours laughing about that. A good time was had by all. Something happened around the water cooler of the Free Beacon, or in one of the slacks they're in.
Or in an elevator.
Or just in a,
while they were all waiting to get rescued by the fire department,
something happened, and they let, you know, all their friends in on the fact that we are exactly as bad as the people who send them frog and oven images all day long, because we sent them photos of elevators and trains. So
that's the same thing.
Same thing. And, you know, I think there was, like, the line was something like, I finally found a Twitter that's even more unhinged and repellent than the alt-right. I'm talking, of course, about Chapo Trap House Twitter. So,
hell yeah.
And what I like about that is that they're sort of giving away the game when they find us as or more morally offensive than actual Nazis. It's sort of like, well, what does that say about you?
Well, for one thing, it says that what they're really bothered by isn't any kind of ideological thing. It's the fact that our insults are actually effective and cutting. Because they can hear, like, getting called cuck a million times. It doesn't mean anything to them. As we've seen, how many of these dorks are like, well, you know, if being a cuck means having a respect for the Constitution and for American values, then, sir, I'm proud to be a cuck.
Yeah, I'm a cuck.
You know, they get the Pepe oven meme, and they're like, wow, you don't know how bad you look right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're like, you spend your entire life, trapped in an escalator, you dumb asshole. That, like, cuts them to the quick because they do spend their entire life stuck in a fucking escalator.
Well, that's the thing, is that they would prefer to have the alt-right as their adversary because that makes them look good. Whereas, you know, yeah. Chapo Trap House Twitter is like, you write for a fucking make-work job at a heavily subsidized, just a slush fund for fucking rich kids, that you're a fucking movie critic at a magazine nobody reads, that in any free market wouldn't exist, like... And then you spend the other half of your time lamenting about, you know, the decadence and laziness of your fellow generation.
Yeah, yeah. No,
so you're fucked, you loser.
From being caught on, like, a parasailing rig that's like, floating away from the tourist resort. And guys with giant hooks are trying to bring you back to Earth.
Yeah, you're a bunch of fucking sad, pear-shaped fucks who all work for conservative welfare publications. And, you know, don't take our word saying that this cuts them to the core, because FBI Bill seems to have deleted every fucking tweet he's ever made.
Yeah, FBI Bill nuked his account. But, yeah,
that Jeff guy. There's some guy who works for a website called Decision Desk.
Jeff,
which
Esoteric Jeff.
Yeah, Esoteric Jeff works for Decision Desk, which I think is like
Carl Digler shit.
It's like the only website that a jitterbug can go to. Like, more people who are fucking dying read that website than anyone else. It was like, oh, yeah, this Twitter's, the Chapo Trap House is really sad. Oh, I'd really be sad if I was a progressive writer in Brooklyn who wasn't good enough. Dude, your entire party got taken over by a fucking reality TV guy who just got there by insulting your candidates' wives over and over again. And your website is read by terminally ill grandmothers who are giving away reverse mortgages because they saw old ads with Fred Thompson on TV. You're the saddest fucking bitch in the world.
If you write for the Free Beacon, that's not a real job.
No, yeah, you're a welfare kid. Like, and you don't, and you don't actually need it. You don't actually need it. You could be an actuary or something. You are like Sheldon Adelson. You're sucking from his fucking glorious, huge hair-covered teeth because you have no pride and you have no skills. And the only thing you can do is just write fucking breathless 5,000-word unreadable bullshit about how much teenagers having sex scares you.
These guys are exactly like Kahina and all the insane communists who hate us, in that they basically don't understand humor. It's like,
hey guys, little breakup in the action. Will got, he was actually doing the show from an elevator that was in a double-decker train, and both the train got caught in a tunnel, and Will was caught in an elevator, so due to technical difficulties, he is not going to be here for the conclusion of the show, but we're going to keep going.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to him.
But, so basically what we want to say are, you know, what we've been saying about the elevator, right? There are a bunch of sullen, sort of a coalition of cynical... warmongering psychopaths, and the brand that we interacted with, which I guess you would call like sexually retarded lunatics, who have zero influence on the world and are watching their grip and influence over their own party get obliterated as guys call them cucks, yet we make them more mad because we accurately describe them.
Yeah, their self-loathing just... it really gets triggered by the shit that we tell them. And then they have to freak out and pull, like, the only move they have, which is this sort of sad, status-obsessed thing of like, oh wow, bet your employer likes seeing you tweet things that are that immature, unlike me, who's very mature, tweeting 55,000 times in the middle of the night at people who, you know, are calling me an elevator dork.
Yeah, also, like, I make more than even elevator esoteric Jeff or whatever, who appears to be about 52. But, we just want to say, fuck elevators, fuck the Pepe Frog.
Yeah, take the stairs, fuck every, you soft bastards.
Yeah, you could fucking use it, guys. But, we also want to say thank you to Maria.
Yes, thank you.
Maria, you did a fucking great job. We're going to have a link to the article up, and, we've got some really fun shit to do this coming week with our bonus episodes. I'm sort of letting you behind the curtain, but depending how things work out, it'll either be Derek Davison will make his third return, or we'll have Lowen Ofgen on for the first time, but any number of those in the next 2 weeks, and another great episode of Frost Crispin coming up.
Yeah, it's in the can, and it'll be out middle of next week.
All right, see everybody next week.
Okay. You getting mad?
You getting mad?
I'm getting rich.
Me.
You getting mad?
You getting mad?
I'm getting rich.
Watch out, little bitch.
Watch out. Watch out.
Watch out, little bitch.
Watch out.
Watch out, little bitch.
Sip on. Hey, watch out, little bitch.
Watch out, little
bitch.
You getting mad?
You getting mad?
I'm getting rich.
Rich.
You getting mad?
You getting mad,
bitch? You getting rich?
Yeah.
You getting mad?
You getting mad?
I'm getting rich.
Me.
You getting mad?
Studying the real world, studying the secrets, becoming informed, becoming involved, that will empower you. That will make you strong. And then, when you do something that is fleshly that God gave us for enjoyment, the sex is 50 times better. The food is 50 times better. That's a low number. Beauty is so much more beautiful. Everything is seen in clear eyes.